So the journey from cycle of suffering to circle of resilience is A, waking up to these three roles that cause suffering inside of us, and then B, actively cultivating these alternate roles and learning how to respond to ourselves in the day-to-day. Because for every situation where you're hurting or stuck, there are these ways of responding that will help you thrive. And at least in the way that I frame it, what the book walks you through, this is the foundation for long-term resilience.
You're listening to the Feed Your Wild podcast, a conscious lifestyle show about all things nourishing for your body, mind, and soul. I'm Vanessa Rodriguez, and join me for candid conversations with changemakers, exploring health and wellness, food as medicine, intuition and spirituality, and nature-based practices that will transform your health and feed all parts of your wild self. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to Feed Your Wild. I'm your host, Vanessa Rodriguez, functional nutritionist, Akashic Soul Record reader, and intuitive nourishment guide. And I don't know, I kind of felt like humming that tune a little bit there. I think it's because I'm really excited about today's episode as we talk about joy and resilience with Anjali Sharon. She is an incredible therapist. She specializes in trauma recovery, resilience building, and as I said, cultivating joy. She just released a phenomenal book called Joyous Resilience, A Path to Individual Healing and Collective Thriving in an Inequitable World. And my, do we really need that in today's world and state of affairs? Don't you agree? I love Anjali's approach and lens, and really her focus on not just building resilience, but doing so joyfully, reclaiming that joy that we all have access to, no matter what's really happening in life. While there's so much information out there that's available on how to build resilience, thank goodness, from things such as meditation and exercise and nature to various neurological therapies and embodied therapies. But what about joy? We're all dealing with really heavy stuff these days, and mainstream wellness culture doesn't really account for the many ways that social oppression and economic injustice intersect to make resilience really difficult for so many of us to access in the first place. So where do you start? How do you begin this healing path to joy? Well, Anjali wrote a book on it, and she's here to talk all about it. Before I get into some of the themes that we discuss on the podcast, I do want to make an announcement, and that is today, May 17th, 2021, we have opened the doors to enrollment for the Feed Your Wild Voice program, activating your inner voice and speaking your authentic truth as a clear channel. In this program, we will cover how to find and trust your inner voice, dissolving blocks in your throat chakra, gaining clarity, getting out of your own way so you can be a clear channel and speak your authentic truth. We are covering all aspects of the throat and voice. We will be covering Akashic Insights, of course, but common energetic and spiritual blocks, physical manifestations linked to voice imbalances. So, for example, thyroid issues, tonsillitis, tonsil issues, sore throats, oral issues, and of course, remedies, herbs, plant allies, tools, and practices to tend to your wild voice. This is a multi-dimensional, multi-lens program. So we're going to be looking at the voice and going on a journey together in exploration of your unique voice. What's going on there? So who is this program for? Wild-hearted helpers, healers, creative change makers, artists who are experiencing challenges with connecting with or expressing their inner voice and truth. And those who have throat-related issues, for example, thyroid issues, and anyone seeking to support the health of this incredibly important center. This is also one of our centers of manifestation and our personal and collective stories. The throat chakra and this center of voice is huge. And I really believe that now is the time for all of us to connect with and fully express your inner voice. I really feel that we are being called to step up and to move through a lot of the blocks that we might be holding that we're not even aware of. They might be subconscious, energetically inherited. And we need to work through these in order to be able to express our authentic truth and step out into the world as those change makers, helpers, healers, and supportive earthlings to share our gifts with the collective. If this is sounding interesting to you, then I recommend you check out the Feed Your Wild Voice webpage. You can find that at wildlyrooted.com/feed-your-wild-voice, all one word. You can read all about it. Doors to enrollment are open and modules are going to begin later this month. So you're going to sign up to enroll and we'll all journey together beginning on May 31st. That's when the first module goes live. And each week, a new module will open up. Within each module are pre-recorded instructional videos, guided meditations, exploratory exercises, and there is a rich collection of bonus material to help deepen your connection with your throat center, inner voice, and authentic expression. So again, you can learn more by clicking the link in the show notes or going to wildlyrooted.com, feed your wild voice. I cannot wait for you to join us. And if you have any questions at all, you can, of course, reach out to me. I'm over on Instagram or via email. My handle on Instagram is @wildlyrooted. And you can also email us at hello@wildlyrooted.com. Okay, so let's get back to this episode with Anjali. First of all, Anjali shares, what is joyous resilience? What does it mean to her? And why she intentionally focused on bringing joy in healing at the forefront. Anjali shares her personal story of healing, discovering and moving through layers of trauma, including inherited, ancestral, societal, and grief. Anjali shares how she found her voice by connecting to herself and expressing the various layers of emotions held in her body, and how supportive and helpful group therapy was in her own experience, and how powerful it was to watch the magic of people coming alive, which drew her to becoming a healing practitioner herself. Anjali breaks down the cycle of suffering and the circle of resilience models, how she got inspired to write about this model, and how it helps folks in building resilience. We also talk about the various roles that Anjali has identified and has in her book, roles that we all have within us and that they each have a specific voice, and some of which include the neglector. I share a little bit of my personal story and background with the neglector and as a reformed people pleaser. Anjali talks about the various kinds of critic that can show up and that internal voice that really destroys the sense of self and the importance of connecting with the vulnerable self to break the cycle and really recognize the lies that we've been sold. So Anjali really helps us to understand how to discern between the various voices that we carry and which are actually supportive versus hurtful. She also talks about how to express anger in a healthy way and the importance of having a container to do so and how to tell when the anger is actually unhealthy. And I think that part of the discussion is actually really helpful in illuminating it was for me, and I know it can be for many of you that have reached out to me saying just how much anger you're feeling right now. And of course, we touch in on the rage and the grief that so many folks are carrying right now, and the importance of honoring that, how we can do so in a healthy way, and channeling it through actions in our lives. Anjali also shares a little bit more about what helps her to express her emotions and get back in touch with her joy, and what centering joy as a practice in life looks like for Anjali, and how to sustain it during challenging times. Such a rich, juicy conversation. I'm excited for you to dive in. We would love to hear from you, your feedback, and what you thought about the conversation. Feel free to reach out to both myself on Instagram, Wildly Rooted, and reach out to Anjali. I'll have her links and contact information below. I'm sure she'd love to hear from you. She also has a special gift for all of you listeners, and that is a gift of 9 resilience meditations to cultivate the healthy, positive voices that we mention in this podcast episode. Links to that will be available in the show notes on the website as well. All right, so here we go with our wonderful conversation with Anjali Sharon. Welcome back, everybody, to Feed Your Wild. Today, we have Anjali Sharon. Anjali's a Pakistani-American licensed marriage and family therapist specializing in trauma recovery, resilience building, and cultivating joy. She has 15 years of practice working with immigrant, South Asian, Middle Eastern, Muslim, and LGBTQI+ populations. Shireen received her BA in Sociology and Anthropology from Mary Washington University and her MA from CIIS. She is trained and mentored with leading figures in trauma recovery and energy psychology, including Richard Strozzi Heckler, Stacey Haynes, and Viana Stibble. In addition to awards for academic excellence and community service, Shireen received the 2007 Emerging Leader Award from the E Women Network and has been featured in O Magazine as a finalist for the O Magazine White House Leadership Project. Her new book is Joyous Resilience, A Path to Individual Healing and Collective Thriving in an Inequitable World. And I'm so thrilled to dive into this juicy book and all the medicine that you share. Anjali, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Vanessa. I'm excited about the conversation.
Me too. We had a pre-chat and there's so much that we can cover. And I thought the first place that we can start our journey all together with those listening is bringing in your definition of joyous resilience as a bit of a primer to getting us started. And I know that that's really big and it is the title of your book, but I'm curious because so many people have varying definitions of what resilience means to them. And I love to hear your insight into that.
Yeah, I think it's a great place to start. And I think what I'll start actually is with the joyous part, which is where people often ask me, like, why joyous resilience and why not simply resilience? And I think especially a lot of times people will think that joyous might mean simply being happy, like almost like a one shade of emotion. And so for me, joyous resilience actually means joyous is to be fully alive. And the aliveness that includes all of our feelings, all of our sensations, all of our lived experience. So joyous resilience is this incredible aliveness that all of us has, our life force, and the ability to actually allow that life force to express itself over and over again, even inside of life's biggest stressors, to be able to tap into that life force and have it come out as the resilience piece in joyous resilience is to have it come out as self-nurturance, the ability to have self-protection in terms of boundaries, creativity and play, and a connection with the larger world, our soulful self. So joyous resilience is this immense aliveness inside of ourselves that is nurtured by these aspects, these voices in us that let us thrive.
I love this. I love that you bring in joy as sort of this North Star also mm-hmm. to support us, because I think that there's, at least in the ways that I have really looked at personal self-help and sort of the wellness industry, is mm-hmm. that there is a lot around resilience and getting healthy and healing, but there's mm-hmm. not a lot of talk about joy and joyfulness mm-hmm. and actually yes. like pleasure and experiencing mm-hmm. life in a joyful way. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. That is actually where the book came from, and the title Joyous Resilience, or why I had a lot of my healing work begin to focus on the joy aspect for that very reason, because same as you, in my own healing journey, it was about a couple of decades now, no one talked to me about joy. You know, in my own therapeutic journey, it really was an act of like at some point hitting a plateau around healing and realizing I am well and I do have a lot of what I want. And then there's still something I'm yearning for. And it was in the exploration of that that I realized what it was actually access to play and pleasure and creativity and like a fundamental, you know, like a happiness that like came from access to those aspects as well and actually centering them. Not only centering healing work as like working through the pain and the trauma and the suffering, which is, of course, deeply important, but an active, I think, focus, look at and practice around joy. And it changes everything when you put that at the center, when you put your focus on it. And yeah, it is interesting that it's not actually talked about as much.
Yeah, I wonder about that a lot. It's almost like the part of the great forgetting. I feel like as humans, we've forgotten so much mm-hmm. about being human, what it is to be human. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about your own journey to joy and how you came to this work and eventually to write this book, which you touched on, but a little bit about your story.
Absolutely. And I was thinking like in terms of that idea of joy being aliveness, right? And that like you don't actually have to access joy necessarily through a happy place. And so for me, for example, my journey began, I came here from Pakistan when I was 18. And in the first couple of years of moving here, and I moved here on my own, my family still lives there. And so when I moved here, a lot of it was like a very solitary journey. And in that solitariness, there was, I think, a lot of unknown grief and a lot of unresolved trauma from just living in that country and just from different family things that happened for all of us. And so when I first came into healing work, I actually came in because of that grief, which actually was in the guise of a lot of anger. I mean, anger that was coming out in relationships. So if you look at that starting point, it definitely doesn't seem like a recipe for joy. And yet, I think one of the first times that I felt a lot of exhilaration and aliveness, and if I make that akin to joy, was when I learned how to express my anger in an embodied way in therapy, like moving it out through my body, getting to be able to express it through like yelling into a pillow or moving my body or hitting down onto a pillow and like actually allowing rage and anger to move through me, ancestral rage, rage about gender-related trauma. And the sheer exhilaration of being able to express that amount of force without harming anybody else or harming me. And I think looking back, I was like realizing like that was a huge opening of energy, life force energy and aliveness for me and liberation. And then going further down the road of that therapeutic journey, I learned not only to express that emotion, but then to also express and deeply feel the grief that was underneath. The grief and loss of a homeland, a country, and relationships. And after that came the further liberation of being able to express the needs that were tied in, my anger, and the boundaries and the limits. So like really finding my voice in a way, as I said, that like was actually nurturing to me, firm and kind with others, and could actually draw connection to myself. So again, none of these things are framed as joy necessarily, and yet because they help me feel much more fully alive and much more free in my interactions and much more free to be myself, they were the beginning of that joy, aka aliveness, aka I get to have all of myself and my feelings. And so as I was doing this personal work, it was happening within individual therapy and it was happening within group therapy. And I think especially the group therapy was very moving for me because it's one thing to sit one-on-one with a healing practitioner, you know, and you know that you're changing, but it's a very introspective process. But in group therapy, I think, and especially the kind of group therapy that I was in, it was very embodied. Everything was not just talked about, like we were really working through it, like through our whole being, through breathwork, through psychodrama, through dream dramas, through actually you know, clearing things up with each other through nonviolent communication. And so what I saw in those processes was really also other people coming truly alive, and the raw vulnerability of people having access to their tears and their anger and their longings and their dreams and their fears, and like not having to hide that. And again, the palpable aliveness in the room. And noticing at the end of those group therapy sessions, no matter how deep we went, like it was almost as if the deeper that we went and the more that we released in our authenticity, the freer and more joyous we felt as we left those sessions or as we interacted with each other. And watching that, like watching the like magic of people come alive, that is really what drew me to not only do I want to do this work for my own self for the rest of my life, but I really would love to be a catalyst for other people. And so that's really what drew me to my journey to become a healing practitioner. And then, you know, over the past couple of decades, the model that I talk about in the book and the things that I'm speaking to now, that model takes off of some of the first things that I was introduced to at that time, and then building upon it and really learning through my work with clients over the years, like what is this path to cultivating joyous resilience inside of ourselves? And that it really comes from cultivating particular aspects of ourselves that allow us to be all of who we are. So that's, in a nutshell, how we got here.
This is so beautiful because you paint this picture of your individual, personal, transformative journey, but also in a collective, like in this field with the group, and how important that is. And you touch in on that in your book as well, which we can talk about in a little bit, but this transcendence of the self at some point and into the collective and remembering that we're a community healing together on many different levels. So with all of your experience and coming into this work professionally, you have put together a framework, which you share in your book. And I love the way that you have put this together because it's so clear. It's so clear and simple. And I think the most profound things can be shared in very simple ways. That's how you know you really hit the mark. But as I was reading through, I was identifying each character or role that you mention in my own life and in others, and I found it profoundly helpful. So I'd love to touch in on the cycle of suffering and the circle of resilience. So how did you get inspired to write about this model? And perhaps we can just talk a little bit about that to teach people what they are.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I love that when you were walking through, you were seeing yourself in it. It was exactly like that for me when I first got introduced to it. So the cycle of suffering draws on a model called the victim triangle, which comes from a different psychological modality. And I updated that model to talk about basically these three different roles that all of us pretty much engage in, whether it's internally within ourselves or within our relationships. And a lot of the times when we feel like we're stuck or we're suffering and things feel like they're not moving anywhere, it's highly likely that it may be because we are enacting one or more of these roles. So the cycle of suffering is basically, if the people who are listening, if you want to imagine a circle and, you know, it's kind of going round and round, and there's three roles on this circle that are interacting with each other. And those are the vulnerable self, the neglector, and the critic. So the vulnerable self is where we want to start. And that's the part of you that at any moment in time might be feeling scared of something or procrastinating on something, maybe angry or upset or feeling down. It's whatever emotional state that you're in. And when you're having that emotional state about a particular issue, it's really what happens next that counts. And in the cycle of suffering, oftentimes what happens next is that either we respond with the critic. So we look at that part of ourselves that's hurting and we go, what is wrong with you? Why are you feeling this way? Other people don't feel this way. So we compare to another person. We put ourselves down. We might shame ourselves. It's basically a barrage of criticism coming at us. And what happens is in the face of that emotion might get shut down, but it doesn't necessarily go away. Or it may actually begin to grow into more anxiety and more frustration and more feeling bad of ourselves. And the next thing that may happen is we may then deal with that second sense of overwhelm by neglecting ourselves, which can look like tuning out, dissociating from our feelings. It can look like addiction to like different substances. It can look like feeding ourselves, but not necessarily feeding ourselves because we're hungry or what's good for us, but feeding ourselves so that we don't have to actually feel these emotions. Or it can look like saying, my feelings don't really count, you know, let me just focus on other people. So overworking, saying yes to other people and other people's needs because it's really hard to actually focus on our own. So these two ways of responding, criticism or neglect, I also just want to name, they're usually learned. We all do it. They're usually a template of how we were likely treated when we were growing up, how were our feelings and needs responded to. And if they were responded with that kind of attack or put down or it shouldn't exist, or if it was responded to by being ignored, not really being paid attention to, hands down, most likely when we feel something, we won't know what to do with it except to respond in these ways. And the difficulty is, like I said, it's a cycle of suffering because what that does is temporarily it might stop something, it might block our feelings, but long term, it just keeps us more and more stuck and more entrenched. So there is hope, because I know when you first hear this, it's like, okay, that's a lot. I'm like, what do I do and how do I get out of it? And the good news is, and what I found basically in the past couple of decades of doing work with clients and on myself is, A, it was incredibly liberating to begin to look at my life situations and where I was stuck from the lens of these three rules. Because all of a sudden it wasn't just, oh, I'm a procrastinator, or I can't do this thing, or I'm always angry, or I'm depressed. It actually was looking at something and going, oh, I'm feeling a certain way, and it's probably because I'm responding to myself in these ways. And that was immensely liberating. Because once I can see that, I can actually begin to look. And I want to imagine, have everybody imagine looking at a different circle. And this circle is going to be called the circle of resilience. So this circle is the antidote roles to these three figures we just talked about. And in that circle, really what you learn is over time, how to slow down and recognize you're actually having feelings and sensations in your body. So that vulnerable self of yours is actually your emotional self. And it deserves to be attuned to. And in that attunement of learning, what am I feeling and what's happening in my body and what am I needing? You're actually building a nurturer instead of a neglecter. The other side is when you look at those feelings and you actually have boundaries within yourself around when I notice that, there's a line that I won't cross in how I speak to myself. So you actually move the critic into a protector. And the protector is really saying, I'm here for you. I'm here to make a stand for you. You deserve to be spoken to with respect. And when you have feelings and sensations, they're probably pointing to needs. And I'm here to advocate for you, help you set boundaries. So that's the antidote to the critic, is the protector. Once you have a nurturer and a protector responding to your vulnerable self, responding to that pain, automatically the vulnerable self shifts into a resilient self. Because resilience really is like that child who falls down or was having a hard time, and when they're picked up and put on their parents' lap and listened to and comforted, and when they're taught, like, I will help you when you get back up, they naturally feel more buoyed and confident and strong and can bounce back and try again, bounce back and reach for things that might have been hard to reach for because they know they have the backing of these two really parental figures in a way, nurturing and protective figures. The last piece on the circle of resilience to cultivate, and it doesn't have to be the last necessarily, it's just the order that I'm going, is your soul self. And the soul self, and again, as I say this with the people who are listening, you might have multiple ways of accessing the soul self. The soul self is the part of you that looks beyond yourself, that remembers that we are more than just these bodies. We're tied to something much larger. That might happen for you when you go out in nature and all of a sudden those worried thoughts drop away even for a second, and you have access to some peace or some like a quieting down of your inner voice. You may access your soul self through service and actually giving to others. But the difference in that versus neglect is when you're giving to others is actually reinforcing for you that you too deserve the same care. Soul self can be accessed through spirituality, through ritual, anything that lets you remember that you are part of a greater whole and deserving and connected to a profound love. So the journey from cycle of suffering to circle of resilience is A, waking up to these three roles that cause suffering inside of us, and then B, actively cultivating these alternate roles and learning how to respond to ourselves in the day-to-day. Because for every situation where you're hurting or stuck, there are these ways of responding that will help you thrive. And at least in the way that I frame it, what the book walks you through, this is the foundation for long-term resilience, learning how to be with ourselves in this way, and then learning how to bring these voices to our communities and our work and our relationships to support everyone in thriving.
I thought that this was so incredibly helpful, Anjali, the way that you listed everything out, especially when you brought words and voice to each role. And as I'd mentioned in our pre-chat, one of the themes really of this month is voice and looking at all aspects of voice. And I feel that one of the big things that I see with so many people who call in or who are part of the programs is that they are challenged or experiencing these various voices that are deleterious for their sense of self, that belittle them, and they're not really even sure where they're coming from. And so I'll use myself as an example, and I'm really glad that you actually give very specific words and sentences to speak into the voice that, you know, for example, the neglector might have. And under the neglector, you talk about three different roles that one can express as well: the martyr, the people pleaser, and the addict. And I myself am a reformed people pleaser. That was definitely something that, now looking back, you know, and having done a lot of work around it, I see where that the origins of that came from, really wanting to make everybody happy and to avoid conflict. And especially when I was younger, well, one of the things that I appreciated were the sentences that you gave as examples of what these various roles might say. As I read through some of them, for example, I don't want to be any trouble. I'm fine. Tell me about you. Oh, I don't mind just going along with what others want. These are literally things that would come out of my mouth constantly. And to think that this was actually the people pleaser part of me that was also the neglector. And as you described, the ultimate inner saboteur really hit home, because I feel one might think that, you know, we're being generous when we're putting others first, or in the martyr role and these various other roles, there's a lot of these excuses, or we can make justifications for the ways that we're behaving and treating ourselves, when really the underlying factor here is that we are neglecting our truth and our sense of self. I'm curious, for those who, you know, might be reading this book or feeling into these different roles and starting to see how they're showing up in their own lives, what are ways to deal with maybe some of, like, that initial maybe shock or shame or, you know, like grief or embarrassment that these are aspects that we've actually experienced in our life and expressing in our life and without us even realizing it?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. And thank you for sharing that. I mean, I think what you just did and modeled is probably the biggest thing that all of us need, you know, which is like the openly talking about how common it is with us. And I think especially, I don't know if you'd agree, but I think especially around women, that role specifically, that habit, that like learned behavior of let me put you first. Because I think especially women, and I would say depending upon culture, definitely like women of color, definitely in like South Asian culture, which I belong to, that is highly valued. Like it's a way that we've gotten love and appreciation, is because you gave of yourself, and it's your job to give of yourself as mother or daughter or sister. So why I name that is just to kind of, I think one of the biggest ways to heal the shame around it is to talk about it openly and to actually recognize how common it is. And that is what I meant. And I really talk about this a lot in the book, that like no one is immune to this. We all have these, you know, I mean, they're historic, they're ancestral, they're learned. And so to kind of normalize, and maybe even over time, like to be able to laugh about it, you know, because I mean, it's also like, it is so common. And I think to also have a lot of compassion, which is partly why the antidote is the nurturer, because the nurturer would say, hey, it is okay that this thing has happened. I want to deeply understand why you felt the need to like do this thing, because none of us do these things without it actually having a deeper need, right? And Generally, it is around something around feeling safe or being loved. And so in the book, I talk about when people start encountering these things in themselves is that compassionate eye that reminds them you are not alone. There is a deeper reason, maybe even like a wiser reason why you did this. And maybe it made a lot of sense when you were growing up in the life that you led. It made a lot of sense to actually put other people first or please. And the courage and the honoring, like what it takes to actually look at yourself in this moment and look at that behavior and to actually decide to choose something different, like responding to ourselves in that way and the pain that's coming up with acceptance and then honoring and dignifying is the journey out of self-neglect and avoidance into nurturance and protection. So those are some of the things that are in the book. And I hope that anybody who's listening right now can also just feel it through us. Like it's in all of us. It served a purpose. And then how amazing and brilliant that we live at a time that we actually do get to learn and practice different ways, not only for ourselves, but also for next generation forward.
That's so helpful. And I think that there's also, as you were talking about, the more that we can be open about this, express, mm-hmm. find a safe space, if that is possible for people to access, mm-hmm. to share with others, or to even speak things out loud. There's a part mm-hmm. in your book where you talk about how, you know, we have these voices and we say these horrible things in our inner mm-hmm. voice to ourselves, which we get used to and mm-hmm. say that it isn't that bad. But if we were to hear those words coming from somebody yeah. else out loud, then yes. it lands differently. And how energetically, I mean, it's creating that rift within ourselves, even if we've convinced ourselves that it doesn't hurt so much. Yes. So what are some other ways that we can begin? Because I also feel like the voices can be so tricky. You know, we could think mm-hmm. that we're actually helping ourselves mm-hmm. by telling ourselves something, especially when we're talking about the perfectionist or the fearmonger mm-hmm. under the critic. There's a lot of these voices that could be very tricky. How do we ride those waves and really tease out which voices are supportive and benevolent even versus those voices that maybe are wounded and are hurtful?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that question. And I think about both like for myself and then with clients, like how do we suss this out? And what I find, I mean, here's the thing, the way to suss it out and actually to ask the one who's being spoken to give feedback. And so what I mean by that is generally the voices are busy telling us what to do. You should make that 10 times better, or it's not good enough yet. And I'm just trying to, like you said, like help make it perfect, you know, or like, why don't you take 5 more trainings before you offer this thing? Because you just need to be even more good enough. Or all of these voices are giving feedback all the time. And to your point, if you want to know if they're working for you, if they're on the right track, I would slow down, take a few breaths, put your hand on your body where you feel a response to that voice. That's going to be your vulnerable self, your emotional self. And I like to center the emotional self and ask, wow, and how does that land for you? Right? Like, does it open up your heart when you're spoken to that way? Does it help you feel energized and motivated and like you're ready and you want to go further? Or does it give you knots in your belly? Does it sink you a little bit? Does it deflate you? And you are the one, you, the vulnerable self, the emotional self, your heart, you are the one who actually gets to lead and tell the voices back, yeah, actually, this is how I like to be motivated. This is actually what would make me feel more alive. This is actually what helps me relax and breathe and go towards what I want. So the way out is really to check with our bodies and our hearts and see what is the impact. And the impact won't lie, you know, I mean, no matter how much those voices might go, well, I'm just trying to motivate you, or this is just the way that like, I know that I'm doing it right. The true litmus test is how it makes you feel in your body, in your sensations. And if it's off, again, no judgment back, it's just more of a course correction to go, what would I like better? And what I will say, Vanessa, is I think a lot of times people will go, I don't know. And that's why in the book, I did such a kind of like a granular job of talking about, here's what alternate voices might sound like. Here is how you actually begin to look in your life. If it's in media or the books that you read, or the people that you interact with, how you begin to register what voices your body responds to with more ease, and then beginning to mimic those for yourself. So if you feel lost about, well, I don't know what I would like as an alternate, there are ways to find out. And but it always starts with what would make your heart feel a little bit lighter and a little bit more at ease. And starting to trust that, because I think we've been taught to distrust that. Oh, that's too easy. I don't want to get too soft. You know, like that's not really hard work. And we mistake as if our bodies have to be driven versus loved and eased and energized and brought alive into doing what we want. So that's where I would start, is really checking with how it makes you feel and then giving some feedback back to your inner committee.
Yes. Oh, I love that inner committee.
Yes.
And this reminds me of a section in your book when you touch in on the critic's voice versus expressing healthy anger. Yes. And I think for people, there's a lot of fear around expressing their anger. Mm-hmm. What would the difference be? How would they know that they're actually expressing healthy anger versus the critic's voice?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a good question. It's a big question. Let me just see where I want to answer that from. I'm going to answer it from the lens of, like, I'm going to imagine that the person we're talking to right now who wants to express anger healthily, like the first thing is the container for that. So what I mean by that is, like, we're not necessarily starting first with, like, doing that with another person. If you're not aware of your own anger, or you're unsure about how it's going to come out, or maybe even you've had anger come out, but in more explosive ways or harmful ways. So one of the first things that I talk about this in the book as well is, like, having a container, whether it's your journal or whether it's with your therapist or healer or spiritual counselor, wherever you do, like, where you're really learning to tap into the sensations of anger and express them in the ways that I was describing in my own healing journey, out through your body, through voice, through movement, all of that, where you know that no one else is actually going to get hurt right now, including yourself, right? So we're not harming anybody when I'm saying whatever it is that I want to say inside, because those people are not actually present here. Someone else is holding space, or my journal is holding space, and I'm really just allowing what's in there to come out. So that's the first step, and that's a hard one for people, especially if you've been harmed by other people's anger and you really are wanting not to do harm. But what happens there is that we suppress all of it instead of thinking about the right space to let it out. And to let it out uncensored, because that takes the charge away. Once it's let out, and this can happen in bite-sized pieces. The other thing I've found is people are afraid of anger because, again, when they've encountered it, it's usually in either passive-aggressive ways where it hurts or it stings and you don't want to do that, or it's in very aggressive ways where it's just come out in this loud volume or explosion or a lot of attack, and that's just overwhelming. And so knowing that you can actually express your anger in bite-sized pieces, which can look like I'm going to do 2 to 5 minutes of just breathing into my body and feeling the sensations of anger and actually just exhaling them out, kind of a hot breath or a breath where my tongue just comes out and I really allow it to move through me, or in 5 minutes of journaling or 10 minutes as I build my capacity for expression of anger. So the point is that starting first with your own safe container, whatever that will be, and your own safe facing around it, to start to allow and build your courage and tolerance and just capacity for expression. Second part then is realizing, as I said before, underneath that anger always is wisdom. So your anger is somehow trying to tell you a boundary has probably been crossed, like something has happened that actually crosses a line for you. Or there are needs of yours that are not being met, and so that's there. Or in terms of people pleasers, usually the way we know you've been people pleasing is you start to feel resentful. And so the anger and the resentment is a clue to you about, oh yeah, like actually here's where maybe I said a few too many yeses and I have some no's to send. So the more that we can express our anger and just kind of get out the raw material, then we can really go back to it with more of our kind of thinking mind and go back and look and go, wow, what are the needs in here? What are the actual boundaries possibly in here? And then the last part, which is very important, is anger distilled, like anger when it's moved through us and we start to actually feel and allow it, gives us back a sense of dignity. It gives us back a sense of knowing, like, yes, I mean, I am a human being and I do deserve to be treated with respect. And it gives us courage to be able to say those things in alignment with that. And the difference between that and like rage is, I mean, rage that's like unhealthy or unhealthy anger is unhealthy anger no longer cares about the humanity of the other person. That's why it turns into I can attack you, I can put you down, I'm no longer connected to you're actually a human being. And like I can share with you that I'm angry, without harming you with my anger through the emotional attack or through abusiveness or physical harm. So separating out, like when I know that I'm a human being and worthy of respect, and I know that you are too, and then I am sharing through a processed anger, that's a very different sequence of events than unprocessed, reactive anger without mindfulness. Does that make sense?
That is huge, that distinguishing factor there of recognizing the humanity and not having that need or desire to hurt the other.
Yes.
Through your expression. I know myself, I've definitely wanted to hurt other people through my expression of anger, to be totally honest. I think that's very natural for so many folks who experience anger and these emotions and maybe don't have the container that you're talking about.
Exactly.
Either unable to access that or even an awareness to cultivate that kind of container.
Exactly. That's why part one was so important, right? Like we can't jump to part three. I think people do sometimes. They like sanitize their anger and they come back and try to say things and suppress it. But then the problem is that then it stays and either it turns to disease in the body. So like a suppressed rage, it turns into either depression or sometimes, you know, actual just like somatic issues. Like it's hard to eat because it's hard to like actually like digest food because I have so much stuffed in my belly, which really is repressed emotion. Or I have heartburn, so all that anger that's absorbed in there, or headaches or migraines. Not that these things are only about repressed emotion, but sometimes there's a correlation to that. So suppressing and sanitizing without actually fully giving expression in the ways that you're talking and learning to do that means that you're probably going to feel chronic irritation or chronic depression or chronic resentment. Like it doesn't go away. So part one is very important. When you really do part one and you feel usually the pain that's underneath the anger, which I forgot to say, actually, when you do part one, we get angry when we are hurt or when we are scared. And I think when we tap into that, it actually allows us to come back to the other person. Once you have empathy for your own hurt and scared, again, you're back in human relationship with the other person, right? You realize they're a human being and they're also scared. And so then you're coming back from, I want to connect, or I want to have my say, but again, I don't want to harm because I know what that feels like. And I've also let out all that very natural desire, like you said, to harm or hurt or lash out. Like I've actually given that room so that it has come out, but then that's allowed me to drop into what's underneath it and to actually come back with my heart back in the game.
Yeah. This is bringing up a lot for me because I think there's just so much going on when I think about anger on all these different levels. So there's the very individual personal level of experiencing, you know, anger and maybe perhaps through like, you know, something that happened or inherited anger even. And then there's that more collective field of anger. And the things that we experience in our culture, in our communities, atrocities that we witness. I mean, obviously, I don't have to state everything that has been going on. Everybody is very aware. But this is just even a very small aspect of this. My partner and I just watched a couple of movies this week that resurfaced this level of outrage that I have within myself always. And it's interesting when we have something that's kind of like an activator or a trigger that brings it out. I'll just mention the two movies if anybody's interested. Seaspiracy, which is a documentary that investigates the environmental impact of fishing. Oof, that was a heavy one. And then The Big Short, which is a few years old, but still relevant because it's showing how the financial crisis of 2007 and 8 was triggered by the U.S. housing bubble, which essentially was demonstrated the monstrous levels of greed embedded into our systems and are still there. And there was no repercussions. And so I know there are so many people listening that have this level of outrage, of anger, of despair, of grief that's always there, that's being activated or triggered by these events that are happening and continuously like bombarded in the news. And it can feel so big and overwhelming. What are some things that people can tune into, lean upon, or open themselves up to in order to move through some of these really overwhelming feelings and emotions and to express some of those feelings and emotions in a healthy way?
It's so important what you're saying. And yeah, I mean, gosh, I have to say, just like you, I'm like, who among us is immune? And like, we need to not be immune in some ways, right, to the tremendous amount of pain in our world, and like collective pain, right, large scale pain, and like pain around harm that is being done that requires our anger. So I think I want to tie that to actually the voice of the protector and the voice of the protector inside of us that takes a stand, right? And is taking a stand against harm, whether it's harm on an individual level or harm on a collective level. And to me, like feeling that anger and rage, painful as it is a marker of love. Because if you love deeply, if you love our earth deeply, like you said, if we love each other deeply, if we love kind of our fellow brothers and sisters and people deeply, how can we not be outraged, emphasis on the raged, when we see deliberate harm being done? And I think there's a few things there. I think one, like I have definitely found like when we're talking about like large scale events that are causing this pain and anger, I do feel like it is useful. And I know we all are seeking like resources which allow for a collective holding of that, not just individual. You know, I'm thinking about like this past year and something, the work that I've done with my clients who are Black around just the violence against Black lives, the ongoing violence against Black lives, and the tremendous amount of rage and pain and rightful rage and pain about that, you know, but the onslaught of that, and how even the container of individual therapy, helpful as it is and as important as it is to, you know, my job is to kind of provide that space where that rage can come out and the grief, because they're right next to each other, the grief and the pain and the horror, like the allowance of that and having someone else be able to hold and witness that, it's so important. But I know that I've also found that there is something also healing about the clients to have spaces that are really holding Black bodies and their rage as a collective, as a community, and to be able to cry and rage and grieve together. And I'm thinking about, I'm going to blank on the name. The book is Love and Rage, I think, or I will see if I can find it and tell you, and you can add it at the end of the podcast. Mm-hmm. But basically the idea is like having spaces and to really honor and see like the necessity of this pain that you're describing, Vanessa, the love in it, and that like it really does need space and large containers to hold. So individual, but also with our partners and definitely in our communities, whether it is spiritual communities or whether it's activist communities, sitting together and actually allowing for these. And then the second part is, I think this is where, like I said, our anger, when processed and felt through, has a lot of wisdom, a lot of power. And the power is to have it keep us awake. Like when you can actually feel it and not be overcome by it and not have it go into depression, it is the fuel that says, I will do something and I will stay engaged. And this is not okay. And I will begin to activate my rage and speak up. Even in just you sharing this right now and whoever needed to hear it, instead of it not being online for either of us. I think it is because of the tremendous pain that's come forward that even those of us with like different privileges, myself included, right, like where we might not have to stay awake, it is this pain and then the anger that it ignites and like actually working with that and not falling asleep that lets us stay engaged politically, civically, in our activist work, in our communities, in our own personal growth. So allowance of rage, finding different containers and group, like collective containers for that rage and grief, and then channeling it through whatever way you find to take action in our lives. So really seeing it as useful and just, of course, deeply, deeply painful, but necessary if we use it right.
That's so helpful. And well, I just want to mention, as you said, Love and Rage by Lama Rod Owens.
Thank you.
I believe.
Yeah.
Thank you. Beautiful, beautiful book. And this is such a really important conversation. We're like at the end of time and I'm like, no, wait, there's so much more. But what this brings me back to sort of full circle is cultivating joyous resilience so that we can continue to work with all of these things that are coming up and to make the changes that we want to see in the world. And you talk about centering joy as a practice in your life, as part of this. And I'm curious, because it's always helpful to hear personal anecdotes and like, what does this look like in your life? Mm-hmm. Would you be willing to share what that looks like for you to center joy as a practice? And how do you sustain it during really challenging times like this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. Yeah, I was actually thinking about this when you were talking about, right, like those big feelings that came up. You know, I mean, again, like everybody else, I've lived through the past year and something of this pandemic, and definitely this past year and something of the very big racial reckoning in this country, in the US, which is so important. you know, and also just profound grief over watching just the levels of like just people living lives of such economic inequality, right? And like, I just named these to say like, these are all the things that have kind of like the pains that have been there along with personal pains. And one of the ways that I access joy that has actually really helped me move some of this through, which is nonlinear, is through dance. Just putting on music and like letting myself dance without thinking and actually dance out my emotions. And, you know, oftentimes like when I'll start, like, I don't know what's there. And I'm just moving and I'm moving to the music. And then I'm often surprised by these days, like I said, if joy is aliveness, the first thing that comes back is my aliveness, because I sort of get back in touch with like what I'm feeling, you know. And especially over the pandemic, sometimes what I begin with is the grime of like kind of like malaise or the day to day, or I'm feeling kind of like stiff or kind of like, you know, not in touch with that joy really and that aliveness. And so first is just like having that layer fall away to the music. And then the second is like usually tears come, you know, tears, and like I can feel the pain in my body and having that release. And there's this weird joy in that of just like coming back to myself, like actually feeling my tears again or feeling what I'm feeling again, and like having that just move through me without having to talk about it or make any meaning out of it, but just be allowed to move as I want. And then I think like, you know, since I was a little girl, like I would listen to music and like just like dance in the living room, or, you know, become like the like different figures that I used to read about, the fantasy figures, just through dance and accessing music. And inevitably at some point in the dance, I find myself just coming back to like Anjali, like just the eye, just me and my body, just the soul. And like oftentimes the like tears really like rain have kind of washed away the grime, and like I can look out the window and like see the trees again, or I hear the bird song, or I see the moon, and like these very, very simple things, like being able to see them again and have them touch me and remember that they actually mean something to me, like they bring me delight, brings me back to joy. And also reminds me that like healing can be through joyous means. Like healing doesn't have to be always through focusing on the suffering. Like the suffering can be moved through joyous means, like music and dance. And honestly, like a really good cry or a chat with a dear friend, you know, or like laughing and like getting like dressed up just for the fun of it, being outside in the garden and like learning about like plants and growing vegetables for the first time. Like these very, very simple things that I think these tremendous stressors cheat us out of, or they tell us like you cannot feel joy until everything is resolved, instead of you have access to joy when you just let what you feel move through you. And oftentimes it can move through you in through beautiful means, like sitting outside in the sun in nature, like music, like prayer, like ritual. So that's one way that I access joy. And it's complex. And I wanted to really emphasize that, like just the joy of being alive in all of it.
Mm. Yes, and just holding space for all the complexity, the allness.
The allness, yeah.
This brings me actually to my final question, which is kind of similar. And it's, what feeds your wild, whether that's body, mind, or soul right now, Anjali?
I love that. I'm like, we should start at the beginning again and have that conversation. I love that. And I'd love to hear yours too, Vanessa. I wish I could have asked you these questions back. what feeds my wild? I think, you know, like many people, I think for sure, like being in nature without my head being active, like any way that I can be immersed in nature where I'm really one with the elements, and that can look like going to the forest and taking my shoes off, or like climbing on a tree and just laying on it, like really feeling into my animal body, like what my body desires, right? Like what pleasure or sensation it's craving, and like letting myself move towards it and have it. I think that's also why dance feeds my wild, because in dance, like I'm not being anybody for anybody else. I'm really just letting my body do what it wants to do. Mm-hmm. So I think connecting with my senses and letting myself experience the pleasure of what my body wants to express or have through food, through nature, through dance, through being with the elements, through singing, like all of that, through like touch, central touch, those are the things that really feed my wild. And travel when all of this world opens up. I've missed that very much. So yes. Travel. Yeah.
Right there with you. Oh, man. Yes. And, you know, well, just to give a little bit of yes, like what's feeding my wild, just a little bit, because I feel like it changes every day. You know, I ask this question so often, and I often don't reflect myself. But one of the things that has been really feeding my wild this week is looking outside my window and seeing all of the beautiful wild animals. I feel so blessed to live in an area where, you know, we'll have wild turkey and wild deer and like wild, all these different wild birds show up, and they're just going about and doing their thing and eating and talking and, you know, waking us up at all hours. But
yes,
it's so beautiful to witness the, like, them living their life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And and energetically connecting to them. So that's something, as you were talking about nature, it reminded me of that.
Yeah, the animal body. I love it. Yeah, just me.
Oh, Anjali, this is such a beautiful conversation. There's so much more, but I really want to recommend everybody to check out your book, Joyous Resilience. Every link will be in the show notes, but I want everybody to also have an opportunity to connect with you and your work. What would be the best way for them to do that?
Yes, so it'll be in the links. It'll be probably the best way is my website. And actually, for those of you wanting to cultivate these different voices, if you come to my website and subscribe, you get 9 free guided meditations to actually help you cultivate each of these voices that we've been talking about, the healthy, positive voices, your nurturer, your protector, your resilient self, and your soulful self. I hope that those are of benefit. And you can also follow me on Instagram, and may the book bring you just lots of joy and bring you closer towards your resilience.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Anjali, for all that you do and for being courageous enough to step out and share your medicine and this work, especially now because it's so needed. So thank you.
Thank you. This was a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
Hey there. I made something for you. One of the biggest challenges that I hear from people is that they are feeling stuck when it comes to their health. You're a smart, capable, and creative change maker, right? And you know what you should be doing for your health. So what gives? Well, it's not about willpower. And I wanted to create something that would help you to unlearn the things that are keeping you stuck so that you can get out of your own way and master the mindset of health. That's why I created Wildly Unstuck, where you'll learn the top 5 things that I have found to sabotage your health goals and what to do about them. You'll learn what it really takes to become committed and unstoppable when it comes to your health goals and find the clarity you've been looking for so you know exactly what to do to get back into alignment. And I made it totally free. So if this is something that you want to dive into and create a vision and soul goals for your health and your life and bring your gifts to the world, because we know that we need it, then I invite you to join us in Wildly Unstuck. You can find that at wildlyrooted.com/unstuck. I'll see you on the other side.